You're listening to Vatican Radio. I'm Linda Bordoni. Miners in South Africa have entered the 16th week of a strike, the longest labour dispute since the end of apartheid in 1994. Workers belonging to the Association of Mine Workers and Construction Union at some of the richest platinum mines in the world last week rejected the latest wage offer from major mine owners Anglo-American Platinum, Impala Platinum and Lonmin. Much talk is being spent on the enormous pressure that is being put on the industry, struggling with high costs and low metals prices, and on the effects of the strike on the share market. Nothing is being said of the terrible hardships being faced by the miners themselves. Bishop Kevin Dowling of Rustenburg, home to an impoverished and extended mining community where HIV/AIDS affects 29% of the population, spoke to me about the dramatic situation brought about by the continuing strike. But first, he sets the picture by describing the area in which the miners live and work.
It's a predominantly rural diocese, African villages scattered in an increasingly drier area as it goes west. But the great characteristic of it, what makes it fairly unique, is that around Rustenburg and going east from Rustenburg and north from Rustenburg are the biggest platinum mines in the world. And because of poverty and migration, they have spawned a huge complex of what we call shack settlements, squatter camps, informal settlements is the technical term. People migrating from very poor areas of South Africa, particularly the Eastern Cape, where there is such great unemployment and poverty. People migrating from other countries to the north of us, even as far as Rwanda, I've met people in the shack settlements around the shafts of the platinum mines. And for the last over 3 months, there has been a major strike by AMCU, the Association of Mining and Construction Union, which is the majority union in the big companies there, the three big companies of Lonmin, Anglo Platinum, and Impala Platinum. That has caused incredible suffering. Not only the miners not getting paid, suffering increasing hardship, but as you can imagine, in a mining town, everything depends on the mines. So the contract workers, the support industries, all of these have been very seriously affected. So you see the phenomenon of even white people begging in the streets. And terrible results just in one area alone, health. I run a very big AIDS program in the shack settlements around the mines. And what we found over the past months increasingly is that people, including miners and their dependents, are starving. And our antiretroviral clinics are encountering this horrible reality of people coming there saying, I haven't eaten a single thing for 5 days. And so they are defaulting. And Lonmin issued a statement about 2 weeks ago in which they said they run clinics, antiretroviral clinics, in the villages around their mines, just to the east of Rustenburg. And they said at least 1,000 of their miners had defaulted because of not taking food, therefore the reconstitution syndrome and picking up inf. That's what's happening.
So correct me if I'm wrong, for the antiretrovirals to be effective, one has to eat, right?
You have to eat at least, you don't have to eat excellent food, but you do have to eat food consistently. Because drugs, antiretroviral drugs on an empty stomach, it just doesn't work.
They don't work.
Ideally, it needs a lot more than that, a whole support structure around your life, which we've developed in the program I run, and people can live very, very well then on antiretrovirals. But the basic minimum is food consistently and taking your drugs consistently. And if you do have a support structure in your life, then you can live for years fairly normally.
We heard so much about Marikana last year.
2 years ago
two
now.
2 years ago.
August. It would have been in August, it'll be 2 years.
2 years in August. It was in the news, it was in the media. I've seen nothing about the strikes you speak of today. What is happening exactly? Does the standoff continue? Does the Marikana precedent, is it having effect on the negotiations between the strikers and the mining companies?
Well, that new union, AMCU, came into prominence right at that time. So there was real conflict between them and the traditional union, National Union of Mine Workers. And because they were putting before the mine workers this wage of 12,500, we're going to fight for this, they got a lot of people changed from the National Union of Mine Workers. And then inevitably, as with everything, there's strife, intimidation, killing of opponents. And that has gone on. It's still going on. It doesn't even reach the media. It's so normal now. It's horrible. We pick it up. You know, houses are burnt down. People are threatened. Many, many of the mine workers want to go back and work and have been wanting to go back for at least the last 2 months. And they can't because they're intimidated. There are gangs of thugs that go at night. They know where they work. So if they try to come to the shaft in the morning, they target it. Mm-hmm. It's a horrible situation. And the police are also understaffed. They cannot control that kind of intimidation. It's really horrible. Marikana itself is still in the forefront of the media's attention because there's the Judicial Commission, which has gone on and on much longer than was expected. I think it will go on for another maybe 3-4 months before we get a judgment. The mine companies have obviously had to look at a whole range of issues, which they are doing. But it's very difficult for the mining companies because the perception is that all these terrible shack settlements around their mine shafts are their responsibility. In other words, the awful quality of housing, the non-quality of housing, these little shacks, as if it's the mines who are responsible for that and not the local authorities. The mines say, but how can we be responsible for all these shack settlements burgeoning around our mine shafts? It's simply a result of extreme poverty and all the other social factors which blight our nation.
How large is the community in numbers, more or less?
In the shack settlements?
Yes.
Oh, it's in hundreds of thousands.
Hundreds of thousands.
We've done just around Rustenburg itself, the town where Anglo Platinum and Impala Platinum work, those shack settlements. Then you go east to Lonmin, but just around Rustenburg, where we have church initiatives, education initiatives to train creche teachers and that sort of thing, we have a conservative estimate of 350,000 people in those shacks. But then I would say it's at least double that.
Do you have any idea of what percentage of these people are affected by HIV?
Well, even our Department of Health, and I admire them for this in their discussions, we were part of an initiative and actually right in the forefront of developing what we call the Rustenburg Health Forum, where to respond adequately to the health situation, we called for a partnership between all the players in the health sector there. So there are 17 entities, the government hospital, the private hospitals, the mine hospitals, the NGOs working there, AIDS programs like mine and so on, 17 have come together. And the government has issued figures which showed that from 2002 to 2009, there was an increase from an average 22% infection rate to 29%. Recently, just a few weeks ago, they admitted that that has increased. And correspondingly, in the mine hospital that we work with in a particular way, the Impala Hospital CEO also said that among the miners, the infection rate has increased from 11 to 16% in the same period. So there's a trend. This is one of the areas where the infection rate is increasing because of all these factors. And it's basically because miners have the money, and then you've got hundreds of thousands of desperate poor women, single mothers, migrating, and they can't get jobs. And miners have left their homes far away, so the sexual relationships bring about this terrible, terrible increase in infection.
Notwithstanding all the awareness programs that you run as well.
And that the government runs.
Because we, you know, from the outside, we have the perception that the pandemic is actually decreasing, that the stigma has been overcome, you know, all the things we used to talk about at the beginning of you know, in the 80s when it started.
That's right.
And now you tell me that it's actually increasing. It's very shocking.
When those things are happening, like the stigma, a great deal of work has been done on that by all the sectors involved. Mm-hmm. Yes, there are good things happening. It's stabilizing in some areas of South Africa. There's no doubt about that. But the really, I would say, problematic result of the AIDS pandemic is to be seen now in the AIDS orphans and child-headed households. Conservatively, we've got 2 million AIDS orphans in the country. And, I mean, when you look at an antiretroviral program, it's relatively easy to implement that if you have the personnel and the finance. And you can get your drugs delivered and you can get your blood testing done. It just needs a well-managed program. But when you come to AIDS orphans and child-headed households, these little ones are unique little people. And you cannot have a one-size-fits-all. You absolutely have to have a very deeply developed, holistic program which cares for the individual child. And I think we are going to live for years and years and years in South Africa with an increasingly dysfunctional young person and young adult group if they get onto antiretrovirals, because they have been so damaged, not through their fault at all, because they've been damaged emotionally and psychologically and have not had the loving care of people to enable them to cope. Now, where we can give this in other ways, it's working fairly well. So our program, the one I have, I've got three sites, and you cannot possibly, when you look at numbers like that, think that you can build an orphanage and house those kids there, even with house mothers. You can't. They're just too many. So you have to do something else. And what we did was work with another NGO called Heartbeat, which trains childcare workers. So our home care nursing system is replicated now by childcare workers. Our home carers, in each team, they are supervised by a professional nurse to maintain a high standard of care. Our child carers are supervised by a coordinating child carer and social worker. So what those child carers do, they actually visit the children if it's in a foster home in the shacks or if it's in a child-headed household in the shacks every single day. We get them into school. That's the thing. We get the funding to get them uniforms, books, shoes, everything. And then we get them into the primary schools and then into the high school if they keep going. They are looked after at the antiretroviral clinic if they are HIV positive. And what's so important for these kiddies is that after school, they come to our aftercare centers where all the childcare workers are waiting for them. And there they get a cooked meal, a really good cooked meal. And then they get psychosocial support. They get help with their studies. And they get help, all kinds of other activities which build up their self-esteem, skills, and so on.
So some of them are really young children, aren't they?
Yeah, little ones. 5, 6.
And they're looking after their siblings.
And it's usually a little girl of 12, around 10, 12, 13.
You paint this dramatic panorama, you know, of a large part of South African society, whilst South Africa is seen as the land of opportunity for many.
For many, yes. It's a remarkable society. You can go there as a tourist and have the most wonderful experience of first world tourist. But then more than half of our population, 52 million, is living below the poverty line. The problem is that the lack of service delivery and everything else that has produced so many violent protests over the past months and continually, it doesn't lead to a change of government, because we're too near the apartheid system. The perceptions about, for example, the main opposition party, Democratic Alliance, is that it's a white-controlled party, and people are not going to vote for that. It's too near still, and people are too poor and uneducated to be able to analyze things carefully and be able to analyze behind the rhetoric what the policies of different parties are. In any case, they all say the same stuff, the same rhetoric, you know, service delivery and everything else. So I suppose myself, having come through the apartheid system and all the struggles and violence and injustice and everything else, I'm rather disillusioned with basically most of the politicians, but disillusioned with our government, you know. Huge corruption, which I've personally experienced in the Rustenburg area. Underspending by government departments, which should have been helping to develop the situations in the poor areas. Money being sent back to Treasury from government departments. I think that's utterly sinful, that in a situation like we have at the end of a financial year, because they haven't been spending it and they don't have the skills to spend it. So we've an awful long way to go, even though a lot has been done. I mean, the government touts this often, how many homes have been electrified, how many RDP houses, in other words, low-cost housing, how many of those have been delivered. But then you ask, well, how is it possible that every single day there's a new outbreak of violent service protests, people saying we haven't had services? And it's simply because of migration. You see, there's more and more people coming into the country. I mean, a few years ago, we were at 40 million. Now we're at 52 million.
Are most of these illegal immigrants, or is there a way for them to become part of the system?
There is a way, but it's a protracted business, as I see myself in Rustenburg Home Affairs, particularly Zimbabweans.
Of course.
We had so many Zimbabweans coming into the country, and for them to get work permits or residence permits, it's a very difficult process, and I feel so much for them.
Can we end on a note of hope for South Africa?
Yes, the note of hope. In spite of everything, I think our people, our ordinary people, are truly wonderful. If we can just create relationships together where people feel their dignity and who they are is appreciated, they have enormous ability to know what their problems are and also what the solutions can be if people can be empowered. And I've seen that. I've got 120 ordinary people, many of them illiterate women, who are running this AIDS program with the professional nurses, of course, and management. But they have such an incredible spirit of compassion and care. I'm humbled when I work with these people, because they are an example to me. When I meet them and they've just had three deaths in the shacks and are feeling so down, they'll come and they'll pray and sing. And I'll ask them, well, how do you keep going? As I did many times. And they say, we must keep going because we believe God has sent us here. If it wasn't for us, what would happen? And so God will give us the strength and we'll go on. And that's the kind of spirit. People who can feel, but people also have a great ability to know what needs to be done and how it should be done. And all it needs is capacity building. and basic resources. And if we can find the funding to give them a basic stipend so that they can survive. And I think if we could just continue to build on that in South Africa, the basic goodness of our ordinary people,